Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Hariya Jabbar, who's an associate professor in the Educational Policy and Planning Program in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Jabbar's research uses sociological and critical theories to examine how market-based ideas in PK-12 and higher education shape inequality, opportunity, and democracy in the United States. In this month's podcast, Dr. Jabbar walks us through some of the complexities of school choice, including different kinds of policies that are often considered to be school choice, the impact of these policies on student academic outcomes, and the side effects of these policies on things like teacher retention and recruitment, leadership decisions, and student academic outcomes. As always, we hope you find this month's podcast interesting and useful. So for someone who's unfamiliar with the policy idea of school choice, what is it?
Yeah, so school choice really encompasses a lot of different specific policies. School choice has existed for decades and includes things like charter schools, magnet schools, private schools, open enrollment within public schools, and homeschooling as well, which more people are talking about now in recent years. So there's a lot of different policies that are kind of wrapped up in this umbrella of school choice.
So oftentimes parents or people who are interested in public education might ask, well, don't kids already have a choice where they go to school? Can't families move to different neighborhoods and choose the school that their child's going to go to?
Yeah, so that's one of the arguments for school choice policies has been to really interrupt that link between where you live and where you go to school, because we know that that is inequitable given, you know, historical practices of redlining and, you know, property valuation that has been discriminatory. We know that, and then given the way that property values are tied to school funding, access to high quality schools is not equal. And so one of the arguments for choice is to give low-income families the kinds of choices that have always been available to middle and upper-class families.
When you think about the origins of these policies, where do they come from?
So, you know, school choice has an interesting history. Different policies historically have had different aims. And we've seen school choice used, you know, for everything from avoidance of desegregation by white families, as well as choice being used to achieve the aims of segregation, of desegregation by, you know, breaking the link, as I mentioned, between where you live and where you go to school. So I think historically there have been different types of policies that have served a particular purpose, given the historical context, the political context, the social context of the time. I think more recently we've seen a shift from policies that really try to address segregation in schools with things like magnet schools or controlled choice programs that really tried to achieve more diverse schools, to the shift towards a more kind of emphasis on a market logic, the idea that we need to expand choice because it provides opportunities for individual families, creates competition, and therefore improves overall school quality. So here it's not really about, you know, desegregation or but really just about expanding choice and liberty for choice's sake.
When you think about the different kinds of choice policies that you mentioned earlier, what are some of the policy qualities that differentiate a voucher program, for example, from something like an open enrollment program?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we sometimes people use the term privatization and choice interchangeably, but they are different things. And so some of these choice policies do provide public dollars to private entities, and some of them don't. So for example, you know, school choice that it can occur just between public schools. So there are cities that have open enrollment policies either within or across school districts where you can choose from a public school other than the one that you're zoned to, assigned to. Then there's this kind of public-private partnership model of charter schools where public funding goes to private operators, usually nonprofit operators, but in some states these can be for-profit charter schools. And so that's kind of a hybrid model. And then there are private school vouchers, which provide public funding in different kinds of mechanisms. There's, you know, vouchers and neo-vouchers, but basically the idea is that public funding is going towards private schools that are, you know, fully independent outside of the public system.
When you think about why it's important to think about choice, we talked a little bit about earlier about how some of the early historical arguments for choice was that it was because the system of public education was so tied to the zip code in which you lived and the neighborhood in which you lived. And now we hear things about, oh, it's the civil rights justice issue, or it's the civil rights issue of our time. And so why is it so important to think about choice now? Why can't we just say, yeah, let's just give everyone choice?
Yeah, I think it does relate to what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, how school choice is framed by different actors for different purposes, right? And so in some of our work, actually, we're looking at different frames that are applied to choice, choice as an using an argument for school choice that's based in equity or based in liberty or based in other kind of arguments and values. And I think it's important to understand because it's an idea that just doesn't seem to quit, right? The policy world keeps coming back to school choice in different ways. And you know, I've studied this for several years now, and every time I think about, you know, maybe I'll move on to a new research topic, school choice suddenly becomes, you know, in the forefront again. And so I think we're seeing this now with this rise in school vouchers, which, you know, really hadn't been a major policy, hadn't been a focal point of school choice policy over the past few years. But we've seen this resurgence of school vouchers, especially neo vouchers, across multiple states right now in response to, I think, you know, the kind of politicization of public schools and teaching about race and racism and gender in schools and kind of just how schools have gotten caught up in these larger political debates over the past few years. And so these ideas just kind of, these policies keep coming back to the forefront. And so it's important to study them, you know, understand how they're playing out in every, you know, state or local context.
So we've sort of been talking about choice and stakeholders in sort of the abstract, but I want to ask you about the individuals who are involved in both advocating for choice and maybe pushing back against choice. What do we know about the landscape? Like, who are these individuals who are pushing for choice and pushing specifically for different kinds of policies, like the voucher push that you just mentioned?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, folks in the politics of education have been studying, right? Is what are the coalitions and the groups that are, you know, that coalesce around different types of school choice policies? And I think in general, you know, there's been, you know, historically there had been sort of this bipartisan support for certain types of school choice, especially charter schools, because they are, you know, publicly regulated, governed, authorized. You saw both, you know, communities of color who wanted access to better schooling options, given the kind of underfunding of traditional public schools, underinvestment. And teachers who wanted to, you know, be able to experiment, move away from some of the, you know, kind of more regulated environments and curriculum in traditional public schools, you know, kind of go along with a more conservative argument for choice, which was really just more around choice for choice's sake, expanding access, giving parents, you know, especially now we're seeing this argument on parents' rights. And so there was this kind of, you know, people always talk about strange bedfellows, right, around school choice policy. What I think is interesting is I think some of that is those coalitions are splintering right now, especially with the push for vouchers, because even though there was this kind of maybe tenuous, but a coalition around charter school policy, we're doing interviews with state level leaders right now, and we're finding that the same groups that supported charter schools are not necessarily the same ones that are supporting school vouchers. And groups that are supporting school vouchers tend to be more conservative and really are now seeing this as an opportunity. They had aligned with the charter schools before because they said, okay, well, this is the form of choice that seems viable. We'll support that. And now that there's this kind of policy opening for a bigger push for vouchers, they're kind of pushing more on that. And charter school advocates are really feeling a little bit left behind in the conversation because they're not as, you know, as much a part of these debates around school choice currently.
Oh, that's fascinating. We know oftentimes, even though there are several concerns about a policy, that policymakers can often narrow their policy decisions around something as simple as a standardized test score. So when you think about choice and the way that it's framed, whether it improves standardized test scores, what do we know about the impacts of different kinds of choice policies?
Yeah, and you know, as you mentioned, there most of the work really has focused on looking at the impact on standardized test scores. And those results do vary across different types of choice policies and programs. So the research on the effects of charter schools is generally mixed. There have been studies that show that some particular charter networks showing positive impacts on test scores, especially in the short term. But that doesn't always translate into longer term outcomes like college access or completion or labor market outcomes. And it's really varied. And so I think the research, given how mixed it is and how much it depends on the local context and what specific policy design and regulations are in place, I think the field has kind of shifted to looking not so much as do charter schools impact student achievement, but you know, when and under what conditions, what regulatory contexts matter, the quality of charter operators, how are they held accountable, you know, some of these more nitty-gritty details that really matter in terms of how these policies play out, and especially their implications for equity. I think with vouchers, the results tend to more recently lean a bit more negative, especially when we see these programs get taken to scale. So, you know, neither voucher or neo-voucher programs have really been shown to improve student outcomes. The results are typically mixed. Sometimes there's no effect or a really small effect. Or more recently, there have been studies of school voucher programs in Louisiana that have found even significant negative impacts on student achievement. So, you know, that means that a student who goes to a private school using a voucher often doesn't have better outcomes than if they had just stayed in their public school, and sometimes the outcomes are worse. So those are that's kind of the landscape. And I think just generally the research has been so mixed because of how decentralized these policies are and how much they're shaped by the local policy context.
You mentioned that vouchers historically have been, there has been an equity argument behind them. So when you think about these impacts and the differential impacts on different kinds of students, is there evidence for historically marginalized, racially minoritized students, students in poverty, that are there any differential impacts for them?
To be honest, I don't know that I've seen the breakdown in more recent studies. I know some of the early studies on school voucher programs especially did find, and they were privately funded voucher programs. They weren't these kind of state funded programs. They did have a small positive impact, especially on Black students. But my understanding is that hasn't been replicated in the more recent studies, and especially when these policies are taken to scale. And I think that, you know, is partly because when it's taken to scale, there are other issues with, you know, which private schools are participating and the quality and how are they held accountable. I think the other issues that have been studied in terms of marginalized families accessing choice in the context of vouchers is there has been research over time and in Milwaukee and other places around access and enrollment and actually, you know, staying enrolled in a private school. And so I think there's been research that has shown these kind of disproportionate rates of exit from private schools that, you know, the qualitative researcher in me would want to know more about why and how and, you know, what are the dimensions. But I think some of the reasons could be, you know, issues around whether the private schools have a kind of intervention mindset or if there's this kind of push out type of behavior that we've seen in the charter sector. And then also there are hidden costs of attending private schools, even with a voucher. There are often other additional costs that the voucher doesn't cover. And so that can be a huge barrier for low-income families, especially.
You just described that the evidence around the impact of these policies on student outcomes isn't overwhelmingly positive. You wouldn't think that we found this gold mine of a policy, a silver bullet, and we should just implement it around the country. Yet you also mentioned that it's a policy that keeps coming back. It loses some popularity for a few years. Things like vouchers go away. Neo vouchers come back. They go away and then they come back. Why do you think that is? What sort of circumstances create these policy windows that you mentioned that allow for these policies to come back?
Yeah, I think there's many reasons, I think. One is that I think just the idea of choice itself is something that is, you know, so it's the framing around choice is very compelling, right? I mean, who, I think you mentioned this earlier, right? Like, who doesn't want choice in terms of where to go to school? I think, the reality is that not all families have true choice, and I can talk more about some of the work that we've done in that area. But I think the other reason is that these are, you know, highly organized campaigns, right? The coalitions I mentioned earlier, they are often well-funded, well-organized, working both at the local level, across state lines. We've seen, it doesn't take much to sway a local school board election. And so there have been researchers that have shown how, you know, outside money has been shaping local school board elections that allow school boards to be more in favor of different types of choice policies. And I think there's an argument that people have made that this is really an attempt to undermine public education and public schools. I think the other reason that choice policies have been popular too is that they avoid some of the more systemic solutions and systemic policies that I think are often less politically feasible, but we know are more impactful. So things like efforts to reduce racial and economic segregation, which, you know, is one of the most effective policy tools we have, as researchers have documented over and over again. And so I think my concern is that this emphasis on choice, especially when it's not tied to an effort to desegregate schools, is really just missing the point and missing the kind of more impactful and systemic solutions that would actually address inequality. As an example, we did this systematic review of the literature on competition. So that's another argument that advocates of choice make, is that not only will attending a school of choice have these individual impacts on people who participate, but also have these systemic impacts on students who are quote unquote left behind in traditional public schools, because those public schools will feel pressure to improve outcomes and retain students and families. And overall, we did find actually that in our meta-analysis that there were very, very small, almost, you know, very minuscule positive impacts of competition. But as we argued in that piece, I mean, those tiny, small positive impacts, first of all, many of them go away when we look at the more recent high quality studies. So it really depends on methodology and measures. But also, those tiny impacts are really not going to make the kind of impact that we need to address, you know, opportunity gaps in education.
You mentioned that choice doesn't always mean choice. And I think oftentimes advocates will talk about choice in theory. They say, why wouldn't you want, like what we've been talking about, why wouldn't you want choice? It's just like going to the grocery store. If you want a banana and not an apple, you can get a banana. So what are some of the barriers in real life that keep school choice from being that ideal choice?
Yeah, there's several factors, you know. So one, I think, is what I focus on more is really just the access on the part of families. And so there's a number of things that really impose administrative burdens on families in order to access choice systems. So one is, you know, the application process. Sometimes that means, you know, going from school to school to fill out paper applications and, you know, without a car or without, you know, it can be really challenging to even just to apply for a school of choice. Another challenge is transportation. Some, and again, this varies context by context, but some choice policies are not tied to any kind of transportation policy, which clearly is a burden for, again, people without cars or without access to, you know, high quality public transportation in many places. And so what we found in our work is, you know, we were doing this study of families in Detroit and how they made choices. And we were trying to understand, you know, the stress of choosing, because that's another dimension, is just the you know, there's been work in behavioral economics on the paradox of choice, and just having, being overwhelmed by choices can lead to additional stress and anxiety and dissatisfaction with the choice. But we found this kind of, so, you know, we thought that those types of burdens and stress would be greater for low-income families in our study than for the middle-income families. But we actually found that that wasn't the case, because low-income families reported not having choice. So it wasn't that they were weighing all these different schools against one another. They really only could attend their local public school because in Detroit, the schools that they were considering didn't provide transportation. So that was just really limiting. So the other piece is that, you know, we think about choice as being between equivalent, you know, kind of options in terms of quality, with, you know, variation in terms of, oh, well, this school, you know, has more of an arts focus and this one has more of a, you know, athletics focus. But that is not the case, that schools remain so stratified. And so the choices and the number of seats in the most desirable and high quality schools are very limited. And so it is, we've seen this happen in New Orleans, where it's really frustrating for families and for teachers who want to attend or work in this, you know, small subset of schools that they perceive as high quality and that are better resourced. It's not really a choice among equals, right?
When you think about the side effects of a policy like choice, for students, you mentioned, for students and families, you mentioned maybe some, for some families, those who have choice, elevated levels of stress, for teachers, issues that may arise and where they want to work or how they choose to, or where they choose to work, maybe for leaders. So what do we know about some of the side effects of choice policies?
Yeah, there's been, you know, I think there's a few different types of side effects, right? Most of the work has focused on this side effect of competition and its competitive effects on traditional public schools. I mentioned that already. But the other types of side effects that I think are really important are these kind of access challenges, exclusion, right? There's research on cream skimming in charter schools, and really more push out, I think, is what the research seems to show, that it's more about, you know, students being pushed out of charter schools more than on the front end. But those are some of the side effects. The other one is for students, also segregation, right? So there's some evidence that choice policies can increase segregation, you know, by race and class, and in private schools, you know, by religion. And so given the documented benefits of attending desegregated schools, right, that I think that's an important side effect to consider as well. For teachers, you know, I think there's been less research on this, but, you know, I think the challenges come up especially when we take these policies to scale. So, you know, we know that charter schools have higher rates of turnover, for example, and the kinds of working conditions that are a challenge really for teachers, you know, across the board, can be, those working conditions can often be worse in charter schools in terms of hours and pay and things like that. And so, you know, in the work that I've done, I've looked at places that have had really high densities of charter schools. And in those contexts, it is really problematic to have so much turnover, so many teachers dissatisfied with their working conditions, because there's not a lot of other options, right? So when there's a handful of charter schools in a given city, I think you can kind of sustain that level of turnover or challenges with teachers leaving those schools. But when it's the whole district, you know, it's a different on a different scale.
One of the factors that we know impacts school outcomes, learning environments, is school culture. And I think in the theoretical school choice, there's sort of this belief that what you just mentioned, teacher turnover, that folks can just move in and out of schools. Kids can just move in and out of schools. And there's this sorting that happens, and there aren't any costs associated with that. But when you think about the relationship between school culture and learning environments, has there been any research? Have researchers looked at that and what the impacts of that sort of movement and constant disruptions about who, schools closing and who's where has on learning environments?
It's such a great question, because I'm actually doing a research study on this right now with my colleague Jennifer Holm. We're trying to understand, the impacts of turnover on things like school culture, school climate, how teachers work together, relationships in schools. And I really don't think there has been much work on this. We're looking at the campus level, but I think to your point, like, this is happening, at like whole school in places with a lot of school choice. In the places I've studied, like Detroit and New Orleans, there's whole schools being turned over, right? There's school closures. It's part of the theory of action. It's part of holding schools accountable. And so I think there's these layers of turnover that are important to study. I will say our work is still ongoing, but we are finding that instability in schools among staff really impedes the work of teachers to improve instruction and to be on the same page about what students should know, how to plan, how to instruct students. And so we're following these teacher teams over time and looking at how turnover on those teams disrupts the type of work that they're doing and really disrupts relationships and trust in schools, which we know from quantitative research can have a negative impact on student outcomes.
When No Child Left Behind was first implemented, there were concerns that it would change the goals of public education around curriculum, for example, that it would result in schools and districts hyper-focusing on the things that are tested and then shaping teaching and learning around those goals. When you think about choice in its current form, does it have the potential to change the goals of public education? And if so, how do you think it might change those goals?
Yeah, I think actually there's been an interesting intersection between No Child Left Behind and these high stakes accountability policies and choice. One of the goals of charter schools, for example, was to provide space for teachers to innovate, right? And to, kind of break free from, traditions, experiment, try new things. Part of the reason we haven't seen that might be because of these high stakes accountability policies, right? And also, we know from organizational theory and sociology, right, that there are these pressures to sort of conform to what a school looks like typically. So I think there are like some important intersections. Similarly, when I was talking to principals in New Orleans and they described, not wanting to enroll particular types of students in their schools, it wasn't because of some kind of, innate desire not to serve students. It was because they were worried about the impact on their test scores. And so, still, but obviously that's not very ethical, but it just reveals, I think, the kinds of competing pressures that are on leaders right now, both the competition dimension as well as the high stakes accountability policies. And in terms of school choice changing, the nature of public education, I think there is, especially right now, especially in the context where I am, there is a really strong framing of choice as an alternative to public schools rather than these kind of earlier ideas of, small laboratories of innovation, in the case of charter schools, et cetera. So there, I think, again, in different contexts, different historical moments, choice can really, signal this kind of bigger shift, or it could be kind of a small component of a public school system.
Given everything that we talked about, where choice is now, some of the concerns that you have about choice, what recommendations would you give policymakers and educational stakeholders who are interested in in improving the education opportunities of kids, and who now will most likely have to do it in an educational policy context that in some form or another involves school choice policies?
Now, that's a great question. And it's something that I have spent a lot of time thinking about, because, you know, while, you know, a lot of the work I've done, others have done, might point to, you know, maybe school choice isn't the you know, kind of silver bullet, right, or policy that should be implemented, at least, you know, at scale. The challenge is that, as you mentioned, many districts have some form of school choice. And so I've really tried to think not just about what are some alternative policies to choice that could really kind of more radically transform educational inequity, but also within working within a school choice system, what are the levers for improving access and equity within those systems? So some of the things that I'm working with this center called REACH, Research on Education Access and School Choice. And we've identified these different levers that we think are really important for equity and access and choice, including things like information for families, enrollment policies, and, you know, some of the things I mentioned earlier around like different policies about applications and centralized systems of enrollment, things like transportation, oversight and accountability. And so, you know, my work and others' work has shown that, you know, school choice policies without strong systems of oversight and regulation can really widen existing educational inequities. And yeah, and so I think, you know, one of the questions I always have is, are school choice policies, you know, simply reproducing existing inequalities? Are they exacerbating them? Are they reducing them? And so I think, you know, having some of these guardrails and policies in place can help at least ensure that choice doesn't exacerbate existing inequities in education.
Thank you, Dr. Jabbar, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweet.